From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, the violence in St. Louis continues with reports that police have shot and killed a man just outside of Ferguson, the scene of over a week of unrest.
Protesters are peaceful and respectful. Protesters don't clash with police. They don't throw Molotov cocktails. It is criminals who throw Molotov cocktails and fire shots and endangers lives and property.
Also today, Israel delivers a series of airstrikes after militant rocket fire breaks a fragile truce in Gaza. And as US military support sees Iraqi forces recapture ground from jihadists, the IS says it will take revenge on American targets.
Certainly we've been seeing security stepped up enormously around US, the US consulate here.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. The United States says it's very concerned about the breakdown of the ceasefire between Israel and Palestinian forces in Gaza. U.S. State Department spokesperson Marie Harf confirmed the rockets fired out of Gaza at Israel broke the ceasefire hours before it was set to expire. Rockets from Gaza were headed to the Israeli towns of Beersheba and Netivot, prompting Israel to relaunch airstrikes over the Gaza Strip. U.S. State Department spokesperson Marie Harf also expressed concern about the growing number of displaced Palestinians in Gaza.
One of the reasons, the main reasons, that we want a sustainable ceasefire in place is so we can partner with the U.N. and other countries to begin rebuilding Gaza, okay, to help address the humanitarian situation. Yeah.
Heavy clashes are reported in eastern Ukraine, with fighting between pro-Moscow rebels and government forces spilling over into the city streets of Luhansk. It's a perilous situation for civilians, with casualties growing and tens of thousands fleeing the area in recent weeks. Yesterday, many civilians seeking refuge died when their vehicles were hit by rockets and mortars. There's been another fatal shooting by police near Ferguson, Missouri. Police report the suspect, now deceased, charged an officer with a knife, yelling for the police to shoot him. When he came near, police opened fire. The incident comes as the ninth day of violence brought 31 arrests as police once again fired tear gas at protesters in Ferguson. Clashes first began over a week ago following the fatal shooting by police of unarmed black teenager Michael Brown. The U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder is due to visit the St. Louis suburb later this week. The National Guard has been deployed to the area to support police. FSN's Steve Mort is in Ferguson, and he says the police response has once again come in for criticism.
There was a relatively small number of protesters, but the number of police was so large that many of those protesters that we talked to said it was simply a provocation, that they felt that the police actions were making matters worse, that they'd come to protest peacefully, and in fact, what the police were doing was simply riling them up and causing bad behavior.
Good news from Liberia, where three doctors infected with Ebola who have been taking an experimental drug are showing great improvement. They began the new treatment last Thursday. The drug, called ZMAP, was first taken by a pair of U.S. aid workers who got infected and flew home to the States for treatment. Over 1,200 people have died from the Ebola virus since the year began. It's considered incurable. From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. The United Nations is sending aid supplies to Iraq to help more than 500,000 displaced people. There has been intense fighting in recent days in the north of the country to hold control of the dam in Mosul. Nick Harper reports from UN headquarters in New York.
The UN's refugee agency, UNHCR, is taking tents, kitchen sets, and other supplies to northern Iraq, any way it can, by air, road, and sea. UNHCR says this is one of its largest aid operations, with the hope of reaching 500,000 people in the north of the country. The UN agency is now running, or about to open, a dozen sites in Iraqi Kurdistan, taking in people who've been forced to flee their homes because of the fighting. It's been prompted by more than a month of violence between Sunni militants, known as Islamic State, and government forces. Nick Harper, New York.
And Iceland is warning European airliners to prepare for flight disruption if its Bárðarbunga volcano erupts. The Icelandic Met Office has raised its risk level to orange as seismic activity increases. Our Europe correspondent Sandra Gatman reports.
Scientists observing Iceland's biggest volcano system, Bárðarbunga, say seismic activity, including the movement of magma, has intensified over the last 3 days. It's prompted Iceland's Met Office to raise the aviation risk to Europe's airspace to its second highest level, which is 4 out of 5 on its scale. The concern is high, having seen large-scale disruption in 2010, after ash from another Icelandic volcano shut down Europe's airspace for a week, affecting more than 10 million people and costing around €1 billion. Iceland's Met Office, though, says the volcano isn't currently erupting, but hasn't ruled out that recent activity could lead to a subglacial explosion.
For the rest of the day's news, you can follow us on Twitter at Feature Story or check out our website at featurestorynews.com. And that's the latest from Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. The violence in St. Louis continues with reports that police have shot and killed a man brandishing a knife just outside of Ferguson, the scene of over a week of unrest following the fatal shooting of an unarmed black teenager. Michael Brown was shot multiple times by a local police officer last Saturday. Tear gas and petrol bombs have filled the streets as protests turned violent, with the police operation once again coming in for strong criticism for their handling of the unrest. FSN's Steve Mort is in Ferguson, Missouri.
Well, it really was another chaotic evening. At the start of the night, as I was making my way down to the main area where the unrest has unfolded over the past 9 nights, things were really quite cordial. Most of the police officers there were very friendly. There seemed to be some degree of hope that with the National Guard deployed for the first time in many, many years on the streets of an American city, that would somewhat quell the violence that had pervaded the area over the last few days. But in fact, things turned pretty chaotic fairly quickly. A very, very large number of riot police in full what looks like military gear basically cut off a large section of the main street in Ferguson where these protests have been taking place and started pushing protesters back at one point. There was a relatively small number of protesters, but the number of police was so large that many of those protesters that we talked to said it was simply a provocation, that they felt that the police actions were making matters worse, that they'd come to protest peacefully, and in fact, what the police were doing was simply riling them up and causing bad behaviour.
Police Captain Ron Johnson was saying that officers were coming under fire from Molotov cocktails and bottles and even gunshots. Did you see anything to back up that?
I did not see that personally. Police did fire several rounds of tear gas into a crowd after a small number of protesters reportedly threw bottles at those officers. We did hear gunshots. I was unable to tell exactly who fired those shots and where they were coming from. There were two areas of conflict. There was one area where I was, where there was a sort of an uneasy standoff with police as protesters chanted at them. And then a few hundred yards away, several rounds of tear gas was pumped into the crowd after the police said that they were threatened by protesters. That tear gas very, very quickly disperses around the neighborhood, I can tell you, and very, very uncomfortable. And it was at that point where people started to leave the area. They started to move out as the tear gas kind of dispersed around the area. In terms of what happened there, police say that they did feel that they were under threat. They ordered people to disperse, and then they evacuated news media from that area as well. So it was a pretty tense situation at that point. Very difficult to know exactly what happens. A lot of information and rumors goes flying around the crowds, of course, when these sort of things take place. So it's very difficult to get a firm handle on exactly the sequence of events.
And it seems that as that police or security presence increases, inevitably so does the media interest in this story. At some points, watching the coverage on TV here, it seems that there are almost more reporters and journalists and camera crews than there are people protesting on the streets. Is that what you've seen?
Well, I think there's very little doubt about that. There's a huge media staging area, probably about a mile away from the main street in Ferguson, the main conflict area where these protests are taking place. And there are hundreds, if not thousands, of news outlets from around the world that are covering this. In terms of the journalists that are in the area where the protesters are, again, there are dozens and dozens and dozens of us. And it certainly does seem, to the untrained eye at least, and maybe this is the case, that some of the protesters and the police may be acting up for the cameras. There's a school of thought that, well, if the cameras disappear and maybe the police scale back their actions, then there simply won't be the fuel for the fires that we're seeing night after night after night. Certainly it's a very large media event that this has turned into, and as the evenings progress and more protesters turn up, more and more journalists turn up. So whether that's a problem or not, well, that's something that to be discussed, but it is a very important social issue in the United States. It's an important economic issue. It's an important race relations issue. So it's something that we as reporters want to cover, but we also have to be mindful about the impact that we're having on the community as well.
Another aspect that was being discussed this morning concerning this outbreak of unrest on the ninth night since Michael Brown was gunned down by that police officer is this notion that the Ferguson is attracting criminal elements from not just outside of the suburb, but outside of the state.
That's right. And certainly a number of people that I talked to during the course of the evening actually admitted that they were not from Ferguson. That they were from other parts of the city, other parts of the state, in fact, and that they were there to basically witness what was going on. Now, whether they were contributing to the violence is another matter. There was also comments that I overheard from some protesters who said, you know, now that all the police are here, that they're in this part of Ferguson, let's go to the police station and cause some trouble. Let's go and vandalize the police station while everybody is stationed here. So certainly from overhearing comments like that, it would certainly seem on the face of it that there are people there that are there to cause trouble. And that might have been the case. You know, I was threatened on at least two occasions personally by protesters that were there who described the news media themselves as the enemy. I walked out into the street to get a few photographs, and a man who was very, very angry ran up to me and threatened to smash my camera, take it away. The news media was the enemy as much as the police. Those sorts of elements that are there certainly add a great deal of concern, both to us covering it, but also to the police, that, you know, maybe they need to be on the lookout for organized elements that are there, not just to protest the death of Michael Brown and call for an inquiry or protest any other issues that they have, but also those that are there to, you know, to simply cause trouble.
Steve, you actually came into contact with tear gas during last night's violent clashes. What can you tell us about that experience?
Well, we were probably several hundred yards from where the police discharged several tear gas canisters, and it doesn't take very long for that tear gas to move at a rapid rate down the street and throughout a neighborhood. And what happens is your eyes start, certainly from my perspective, your eyes start to sting first, very, very uncomfortable stinging, and then you feel it in the back of your throat. It makes you cough a lot, and you certainly need some sort of mask. Either a paper mask or a gas mask, something like that, and goggles. And you feel a kind of burning sensation on your skin as well that just won't go away, and you're left with sort of a white residue that kind of paints your skin, and it just hurts even more if you try to wipe it off or you crinkle your face up. You need water basically poured onto your face. You need to get that stuff off as quickly as possible. It's not something that just hurts when you inhale it. It continues to hurt for some time afterwards as well. Very, very uncomfortable. I talked to One man, 23-year-old, as we were leaving the protest, he'd been hit full on with a tear gas canister. He was soaked through. He was he had residue all over his face. He was in a great deal of pain. There were tears streaming down his face. He was good enough to stop and talk to us. And he said that, you know, he'd come along to peaceably protest, and that he'd received this tear gas. It's an extremely painful experience. Certainly, it doesn't necessarily look like it. It looks, from television pictures that most people might see, it looks like it's just sort of something that might make your vision a little bit difficult. But this is something that is designed to make it too painful for you to tolerate. That's the point. When that tear gas canister is deployed, the point is that it's supposed to disperse the crowd, that the crowd will run, that they'll leave, that they can't take it anymore. And that's certainly the sensation that you get.
Steve Mort reporting from Ferguson, Missouri. This is FSN Reports. Israel's military says it's hit terror targets in Gaza in response to rocket fire from the Palestinian territory. The US has condemned the militant rocket attacks that broke the latest truce between Israel and Hamas. Egypt has been brokering ceasefire talks between the two sides, but no long-term solution has been agreed. Over 2,000 Palestinians and 66 Israelis have died since the conflict began on July 8th. Julia Hartley-Brewer spoke to Daoud Kutab, a Palestinian journalist in Amman, about the failure of maintaining a truce.
I mean, it's terrible that we can't get a permanent ceasefire. And we've been basically very close to reaching an agreement. And both times, the Israelis have basically tried to get out of making the commitments that the international community is asking them, which is to lift the siege. The unacceptable siege on Gaza has been really the big source of the trouble. And the Israelis don't want to lift the siege because they say this will be a reward to Hamas. But in fact, it's the entire Palestinian population and the international community are saying lift the siege. And when it's not lifted, then the ceasefire will not hold. And unfortunately, today it wasn't held. And hopefully, before midnight tonight, they would hammer out the last remaining issues that they are conflicting on, and maybe we can have a permanent ceasefire.
We know this is a major requirement, an absolute crucial requirement from Hamas that the Israelis lift the siege,
and not just Hamas.
The international community as well.
International desire.
I accept that, but in terms of this rocket fire that's been fired from the Gaza Strip, is it very clear that this is ordered from Hamas senior figures, or could this just be renegade Hamas supporters who fired it? And allowing the peace talks to be derailed by that perhaps seems unfortunate.
It's usually not Hamas who's doing this, as you said, renegade ceasefire. But Hamas is also not willing to step out of its way and rein these people in because they're also not happy with how things are going. So you're right, it's probably not Hamas who's actually firing the rockets, but Hamas could do a much bigger job at stopping them if they had an incentive, and they don't have an incentive now to rein in everybody because people are very frustrated and they were hoping that these talks, which have been very senior with the U.S. involved, with the Egyptians involved, and everybody's been telling us that we're almost there, just few words. And then every time the Israelis keep asking for an extension of ceasefire, and the feeling is that the Israelis don't want to make any arrangement. They just want one ceasefire extended after another. And if anybody makes a move, they'll mess them up. And that's not, might cannot always be right. Sometimes right is might. And we need to have a solution to this conflict. And the people pay the price for this politicization of the conflict. But in the end, we're on the edge. We're trying to figure out what's going to happen.
Indeed.
And it's not a good way.
Daoud Kutab, a Palestinian journalist in Amman, talking to LBC Radio. Now, the Islamic State militant group is threatening to attack Americans in any place following airstrikes in northern Iraq. A video statement released by ISIS shows a photo of an American who was beheaded during the US occupation of Iraq and includes the statement, "We will drown all of you in blood." This follows President Obama's praise for the ongoing US bombing mission, which assisted Iraqi forces in recapturing a strategic dam from IS control.
Iraqi and Kurdish forces took the lead on the ground and performed with courage and determination. So this operation demonstrates that Iraqi and Kurdish forces are capable of working together and taking the fight to ISIL.
As Iraq's humanitarian crisis deepens, the United Nations Refugee Agency took action, launching a major operation to get supplies to more than 500,000 Iraqis driven from their homes. Journalist Hermione G is based in northern Iraq and spoke to LBC earlier.
Yes, I mean, I think, like you say, it is disturbing to hear it, but I think it's been sort of taken as read up until now that the US and, you know, US citizens and property and so on are targets of the ISIS. So, yes, disturbing news, but yes, I think people have expected it. Certainly, we've been seeing security stepped up enormously around US, the US compound, US consulate here. I was walking past yesterday and there's a building under construction right next door. And instead of it being full of construction workers, it was just chock-a-block with security forces. So they're clearly taking the situation seriously, but I think they have been for a while.
It comes, of course, with the news now that that key Mosul dam is back in Iraqi and Kurdish hands. That must be being seen as a great step forward against IS.
Yes, it's hugely significant. It's very, very important. It's important, obviously, because it was very worrying that the militants should have control of something that could potentially be used as, you know, a weapon of mass destruction, essentially, and put the country under meters and meters of water. It's also very important psychologically because the Peshmerga forces, the Kurdish armed forces, have managed to have a significant victory after losing a couple of cities and, of course, the dam a couple of weeks ago. So it's both important logistically, strategically, and obviously psychologically for the people here.
Journalist Hermione G with LBC's Lisa Aziz. And staying with this subject, Haydar Al-Khoei is an Iraq analyst with Britain's Royal Institute for International Affairs. And he told Sam Jones of the Financial Times that he believes the US intervention in Iraq is having an impact, but may not prove to be enough to restrain the forces of the Islamic State.
I think the intervention by the United States and the United Kingdom so far has been effective in preventing an act of genocide taking place in Mount Sinjar, where tens of thousands of Yazidis were stranded at risk of being slaughtered by ISIS or dying of thirst. And the limited airstrikes was also effective in preventing the ISIS onslaught towards Erbil, which is the capital of the Kurdish regional government.
Right. Now, how important is Erbil and indeed the Kurdish government to the US strategy of containment?
I think the United States made it very clear that the main reason they were intervening was to protect US personnel in Erbil, because Erbil is home to US consulate. What the limited airstrikes is not going to do, unfortunately, is turn the tide against ISIS. It will not shift the balance of power. For that to happen, there needs to be much more military engagement from the United States and other allies to push back against ISIS. The airstrikes are effective when ISIS is out in the open and moving towards the city. They can be easily spotted and eliminated, but it's not going to turn the tide, unfortunately.
Right. So getting rid of ISIS from urban centres like Mosul or Raqqa in Syria, where their real concentration of power is going to be something that can't be done from the air.
It's going to be very difficult, and this is why both the federal government in Baghdad and the regional government in Erbil is calling for the United States to provide more help. The United States, whether we like it or not, helped create the environment which gave birth to ISIS in both Iraq and in Syria. And I think their reluctance to help Iraq push back and fight against ISIS is an outrage. They're not calling for boots on the ground. They just want more intelligence, more military equipment, more airstrikes against the ISIS, and just to provide them with the assistance that they need to fight. The sense in Baghdad and Erbil is that if the United States doesn't have the stomach for military engagement, the least they can do is help them take the fight to ISIS.
It's a bit of a difficult choice, though, isn't it? Because obviously one of the reasons why ISIS has become so powerful is because it has captured so much equipment from the Iraqi security forces, lots of equipment that was provided by the US and NATO allies before they withdrew. So what, I suppose, needs to happen to convince the US to do more, to provide more military equipment to the central government in Baghdad?
What's clear is that Iraqis, whether that's the Kurds or the central government in Baghdad, needs to move forward on the political front. Many analysts rightly point out that there can be no military solution without a political solution. The only thing I would add is that there can be no political solution without a military solution. And they are begging for help. And ISIS, if not stopped now, will only further consolidate and expand their territories. And this, by the way, isn't going to be just a problem for Iraq or indeed the Middle East. ISIS, if it can establish a state in the heart of the Middle East, is going to be a threat to everybody, everyone in Europe, the United States itself. There are many sympathizers of ISIS living in Western democracies, and they are not going to keep quiet.
Iraq analyst Haydar Al-Khoei talking to Sam Jones at the Financial Times. This is FSN Reports. For San Francisco's homeless community, keeping clean is a daily challenge. The city only has 16 shower stalls available for 3,500 people living on the streets. The shortage has inspired one resident to bring showers on wheels to the areas of greatest need, as Rebecca Bowring reports.
A bright blue bus stands out from the crowd in San Francisco's Mission neighbourhood. At the grand old age of 22, it no longer picks up commuters. It's been retrofitted as a free mobile shower and toilet service for the homeless. Denise Sandoval founded the non-profit Lava May, derived from the Spanish for wash me, after seeing a homeless woman crying that she would never be clean. For people living on the streets, she says, a shower can be transformative.
If you're struggling with getting clean, you disconnect from your sense of humanity, and your dignity and your self-esteem suffer tremendously. We have a tagline that says, with hygiene comes dignity, and with dignity, opportunity.
The decommissioned bus contains two spotless bathrooms with toilets, sinks, and roomy shower stalls, one large enough for a wheelchair. It provides up to 130 showers a day in a safe, private environment. Shower bus user Guy Revelo says the service is meeting a fundamental need.
It's hard to get a drink, to get any water at all, to wash your hands. Just look at my hands. They're really, really dirty just because you're out here trying to do whatever you have to do to survive, you know.
Like every visitor, Arevalo receives a free towel and soap, and 20 minutes later says he's feeling a lot better.
Look at me. Don't I look a little more human?
Lava May has worked out a deal with the city to use its fire hydrants free of charge to run the showers. The non-profit raised $75,000 on crowdfunding site Indiegogo, and Google donated a further $100,000. Sandoval says citizens' hygiene is a public health issue and that in an ideal world, the government would do more.
We live in a first world country in a very affluent city, and the World Health Organization and the UN define access to water and sanitation as a basic human right, and yet so many people here go without.
Bevan Dufty is San Francisco's chief of homeless initiatives. He feels the problem is one the whole country needs to deal with.
I don't see homelessness as a city challenge. I see it as a society challenge. I think it's a challenge that we face as Americans, and I think at times people question how nimble can government be in responding to it.
Lava May, by contrast, is expanding quickly, with three more buses in the pipeline and plans to open up in cities across the USA, even Brazil and Singapore. The organization's aim is to help the most vulnerable find a way back into society, one shower at a time. Rebecca Bowring, San Francisco.
And that's the Tuesday edition of FSN Reports. If you'd like to contact us, you can email us reports@featurestory.com, and you can follow us on Twitter @FeatureStory. But for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington alongside Rebecca Foster with The Bulletin. For everyone with FSN everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.